is. So I'm just going to share my screen, which will hopefully bring up the presentation that I've put together, which is not, don't get too excited, people, it's not very exciting. But it just gives us a framework to go around. So, right, fantastic. Okay. So spring has finally sprung, the leaves are getting green, so do make sure that you get outside at some point during the day and enjoy what's going on outside to get away from what's going on in the world. But yeah, just it's nice to see the spring last. And just to remind you, so a lot of people have been directed here through the Emergency and Critical Care Interest Group. Our aims are to create guidelines by you for you with our support, and provide an area for general questions and support as well. So do join up if you're interested in ECC, and do ask questions, because it will give us the opportunity to start discussion, discourse, and get some guidelines going as well. And I know there are a few people that have some already started, which will give us a great grounding for this. Some people have put up some interest in holding journal clubs, and we're very happy to support that, but I can't run them on my own, so I need people to step up with papers that they're interested in discussing, and I'm happy to help you get started to support it and to get these moving, because it's a really good opportunity for us to discuss and learn. So this is the first case that we're going to discuss, and it's a case that Liz was involved with yesterday, actually. I've changed the breed because I didn't have a picture of the real dogs. This is a very old picture of mine. It's really terrible. I'm really sorry, but it gave us an opportunity. This is a sick dog. It's an awful picture, isn't it? It's not even in focus. So it's a sick dog that presented to us, and we're going to talk about it because it's a case that presented as an emergent, very unwell adult. Required. So how do we get this case ready? So I'm going to get Liz to present it to me, and then I'm going to talk about how I would have stabilized it, and then she's going to talk about what we did, and then we're going to talk about the anesthesia. Is that all right, Liz?
Yeah, that sounds good. So I think this dog is it actually was a whippet, which is a little bit strange for the Labrador, but on presence, it's an entire female, 12-year-old Labrador, as you can see. On physical examination, she had quite a high heart rate, so 156 with bounding pulses. The femoral pulses could be felt, but the peripheral pulses couldn't. Her capillary refill time was 1.5 seconds. And her mucous membranes were quite vivid. So I guess Sophie's already asked some of the questions that I would want to look at here. So we want to think about what sort of blood work we want to support any suspicions of what we're going to diagnose here, and to see how the dog is in a cardiovascular status. So I can't even see those results. I've gone so blind.
But I think it's really interesting to actually think about what blood work we need. So in any sick patient, I don't get an enormous amount of information, because what I want is information that's going to help you make decisions then and there. And I worry less about all the information, I suppose, because actually sometimes that just ends up complicating it. And there are a lot of changes that we see on blood that are secondary to other processes. So with emergency cases, I always concentrate on what do we need now? And we can call that a minimum database or an emergency database. I prefer to use the term emergency database, because actually I get quite a lot of information. And what we get, or what we got yesterday, was an EPOC, which is a blood gas metabolite electrolyte panel. And it gives us loads and loads of information, which is really useful. So sick patients commonly have electrolyte abnormalities. So we definitely should be measuring electrolytes in any patient where we are going to use fluids, because it will allow us to titrate or alter the composition of the fluids that we use. Any patient that's really collapsed should have a glucose measured, and that will come out on your EPOC. Urea and creatinine is really useful. And I might hand back to Liz in a second to talk about urea and creatinine. PCV and total protein, it's a really important starting point. And actually, that's probably the information that I would use. I use stuff like the blood gases themselves much less frequently. They're not that interesting most of the time. A lactate can be useful, but I think often doesn't tell us it's actually really unusual to see very, very high lactates in veterinary patients. More commonly, they're slightly increased rather than very high. And so I think we can be underwhelmed by the changes in lactate that we see, and it might not, it might put us, give us a false sense of security with that. Is there any other information that you'd get, Liz?
No, I guess, I mean, for me, PCV-TP is quite important, and that's the one thing, you don't get any proteins on an ECOC.
Yeah.
But yeah, these are the body systems I'm more interested in.
Yeah. So I don't, it would be very, very unusual for me to run a full biochemistry panel on these patients. Really sick animals, if they've got significant alterations in albumin, the in-house albumin tends to be very inaccurate and can, again, I think make you either unnecessarily worried or, again, feel safe. So they can be out by up to 10 either way. So if you get a reading of 13, it could be 3, it won't be. It could be 3, it could be 23, or it could be anywhere in between. So they're wildly inaccurate when patients are unwell or when they're altered. So total protein, I think I agree, is much more useful and probably much more accurate representation of what's going on in the patient. And liver enzyme increases are really common in sick dogs and probably don't mean a huge amount. So I wouldn't necessarily worry about that either. And the other thing you get with your TP, of course, is you get to see what colour the serum is. So you can, if it is bright yellow, then you could think about doing liver parameters if you wanted to. Do you use blood gases in these patients, or is it actually the electrolyte metabolite stuff that you're more interested in?
I guess it's more the electrolytes that I'm interested in. The blood gases can be helpful in, so if you've got a severely compromised cardiovascular system, then you might see some changes. So you'd also see lactate potentially as well. So I think they're all little added on benefits, if you like. So I'm not that worried about them, but they can be useful add-ons, but you've usually reached your clinical conclusion by assessing the patient, more importantly.
All right, so that's the blood work, but I think it's, for me, it's very much supportive rather than instead of the physical examination, and it's the physical examination that we should be relying on to make our assessment of what's going on with regards to immediate stabilization. So this dog, it's very tachycardic. So whether it's a Labrador or a Whippet, it's really pretty significantly tachycardic. And if it's got pulses that are only palpable really at the femoral artery, then we would be concerned that there's significant hypotension associated with that. And that could be due to vasodilation, so loss of vascular tone, which we see in patients that have distributive shock, so patients that are septic, or it could be that there is so little blood volume present that we've got significant decreases in blood pressure as a result of that. Either way, first line treatment for this patient should be fluid therapy administered as boluses rapidly to try and restore some kind of peripheral perfusion. And it's indicated in all these patients. So most of these patients lost fluid, they will be extravasating, there'll be third spacing, and so there'll be significant fluid deficits that need to be replaced. And when there are cardiovascular signs, then we should be treating these first line with large volumes of fluids administered as both. So for me, I would probably start this dog with if a dog that was in front of us just then, probably I'd hang up a litre bag of Hartmann's and administer it pretty quickly. When about half of it's gone down, I would reassess the patient, so probably in 10 to 15 minutes I'd see how that looks. That would equate to about 20 mils per kilo as initial bolus, and because you've got a liter bag, it gives the opportunity to double that pretty easily. So that would be my starting point for fluid resuscitation in this patient. And as I said, I'd use Hartmann's because it's isotonic and because it's relatively well balanced. Did you do anything different, Liz? Did you do anything different?
No, so we gave 2 10 mil per kilo boluses. Heart rate came down to about 140 after those, and you could feel the peripheral pulse as well, which was what I felt was a good sign. I never anaesthetise a dog that I can't feel a peripheral pulse in. We also checked the blood pressure, so So obviously the heart rate is going to be elevated, trying to compensate for any hypovolemia. And it will maintain the blood pressure quite nicely until it reaches that decompensation phase. And then the blood pressure will come down as well. So the first blood pressure reading that I'm just trying to look through our notes. Our first mean arterial pressure was 80, I think just over 80, which is normal. But I felt for a very stressed and painful dog, that was actually a little bit on the low side for me. And then after those fluid boluses, that had come up to 105. So I think we've seen blood pressure come up, and we've also seen the heart rate come down. We also gave this dog some methadone because it was very painful at that point. It had come in, collapsed, and had obviously had abdominal ultrasound, and during that procedure it was quite sore. So we did also give some methadone to help the dog, which is, the opioids do decrease the heart rate, but when you've got a dog that's compensating, it normally won't affect the heart rate at all. So I think given that situation, there's no problem using an opioid. It's a relatively safe drug to give in that situation.
If the dog had been significantly hypotensive, would that have changed your approach to giving methadone? Let's say its blood pressure was 60 or 50 on presentation.
Probably not. I probably would have still given it. I don't see that it alters the heart rate that much. So I don't think in this situation it would have really altered that heart rate. And for me, the reason the heart rate came down was the fluid boluses that the dog was getting.
Yeah. I think the other really interesting point that you've just made is that hypotension actually is relatively uncommon in patients that present to us, even with quite significant cardiovascular signs. So this dog was collapsed, looked unwell, but actually wasn't really significantly hypotensive. And so while measuring blood pressure is really important, really good to do it when the animal comes in and to monitor the progression of it, I think that we should be careful not to over or under interpret it. So to say, oh, the blood pressure is okay, let's leave it for now, because actually this patient did respond and did require fluids in that initial phase. And so it's important to not say, oh, it's normal, let's not give the fluids. It's important to just trust your gut instinct of what's going on. That's what I think anyway. Yeah. Cool. Okay. So if we do look at the blood work, and I'm sorry for those of you if you can't see it, it's a bit smaller than I intended it to be. So this dog's electrolytes are relatively normal. Sodium's normal. There's mild decrease in potassium to 3.2. So I would say 3.6, about the lower end of the reference interval. Interestingly, the calcium's slightly low. So calcium normally sits around 0.2 to 1.3 ionized. So it's slightly low. You can see mild hypocalcemia associated with sepsis. So it's probably an effect of that. It's not necessarily something I would do anything about at this stage, but it's something to monitor. Chloride's normal. Glucose is bottom end of normal, so 3.8. I would be watching that really, really closely in this patient. If you've got a patient that's stressed, that is hypoperfused, then a dog's normal response is to become mildly hypoglycemic. So we always associate stress hypoglycemia with cats when they are obviously stressed. They come into the clinic, you bleed them or hold them down excessively, and they get a stress hypoglycemia. We see it in dogs as well. When they are significantly hypoperfused, they become hyperglycemic, and it's often got an association with lactate. So as the lactate goes up, the glucose goes up. So the fact that this dog's lactate is top end normal and glucose is bottom end normal would really worry me that this dog's going to become hypoglycemic at some point. So that's something I would watch. And then urea and creatinine are interesting, because the urea is actually low and the creatinine is high. So that could be a measurement error, because these machines are not totally precise. But I would always take worst case scenario in this patient and assume that creatinine was real, because that's probably a safer approach to take. What would you do in this situation, Liz? Would you do the same or would you repeat it?
Yeah, I'd probably repeat it if I could do. Unfortunately, we didn't have the opportunity with this case, so I can't tell you if that was a measurement error or not. But
I think there's lots of possible causes. This could be pre-renal. You would normally expect the urea to go up more than creatinine with pre-renal. It could be renal. Either way, we can't necessarily fix a kidney injury. All we can do is try and preserve ongoing renal function. So that would be about ensuring glomerular filtration rates and maintaining blood pressure and making sure that the patient had enough fluids on board. So analgesia and fluids at this point, aiming for an improved cardiovascular system. And I think with these types of septic patients, my clinical impression is that it's very difficult to make them completely stable. Would you agree? You won't get it back to normal.
No, and I think you've got to make the judgment as to when to go in with the anaesthesia and the surgery, because obviously if we leave a septic peritonitis ongoing, it's just going to get worse. So it's better to be trying to get your patient as stable as possible before you anaesthetise it and hit it with all the drugs. We also, on the free fluid, we had that was positive for glucose and neutrophils as well, so that's how we came to our diagnosis of a septic peritonitis.
So next step, we decided this dog needs surgery. It was a presumed ruptured pyo or sepsis secondary to the pyometra. How would you approach this anaesthetics? We've got the patient in a slightly better place, blood pressure's better, heart rate's better, dog's more comfortable. What would you get ready? How would you approach it?
So what the first thing we did was to have two IVs in place so that we would be able to give fluids and we could give any other supportive drugs we needed via another catheter if needs be, so that if things became very critical during the surgery, we weren't fighting just for that one intravenous catheter. Sophie's already mentioned about the glucose, and we did recheck the glucose, and that was going down during this stabilization. Some of that may be hemodilution, but we decided to just place some glucose gel onto the gum so that hopefully it could absorb. I know it's maybe not the best thing in a vasoconstricted patient, but that did actually bring the glucose up. So it gave me time to focus more on the anaesthetic as opposed to trying to correct some of the other problems that were going on. The first thing when you make a diagnosis of sepsis is you should get the antibiotics on board. So that was done even before we started all the stabilization. So we had our antibiotics in. In terms of preparing the patient, I think if you're worried about the cardiovascular system, then having them on oxygen is not going to be detrimental at all, and is probably offers a few positive things for oxygen delivery to the tissues. So what else did we do beforehand? So then we got all our stuff ready for the procedure, and that's not just our induction drugs, our maintenance agents, our endotracheal tubes. We also made sure that we had a plan in case this dog had problems with the anaesthesia. So in case there was hypotension, we had a plan of how to deal with that, with fluids, with vasopressors as well, which I'm quite lucky because I can use drugs like that. So we'd already planned that. We were thinking about the pain as well, because this dog was demonstrating quite a lot of pain, how we were going to manage that intraoperatively to help us provide a more stable anaesthetic. So we had a plan in place to use a lidocaine infusion. So I like lidocaine when you've got any inflammatory states, because it can really help manage that situation. It will also decrease the amount of isoflurane that we need for anesthesia. I think a lot of people think we use these CRIs to try and reduce our isoflurane, and that will improve our cardiovascular system. That's not actually true, and normally kind of the combination of the iso with the CRI, you'll get the same degree of cardiovascular depression with your drugs. So although it's a very theoretical benefit for the cardiovascular system, in reality, it really doesn't offer that much improvement. But obviously, giving good analgesia during the surgery is going to make our life a lot easier. It means we're not increasing our iso, then decreasing our isoflurane, and we can manage a much more stable plane. So we made sure we had our fluid pump set up in theatre, that we clipped the dog as much as possible before we actually anaesthetized it, so that we could minimize our anaesthesia time and just get that dog into theatre as soon as we could once everything was underway. When it came to the choice of drugs, whenever I'm hit with an emergency case, I like to use drugs that I'm used to using. I don't like going out of my comfort zone, because I think you end up, you can miss subtle indicators that there's a problem. If you're used to an anaesthetic technique, you're more likely to pick up on complications during it, I think. But for this case, we're a bit limited in what we can use. So I couldn't use azepromazine, because that's going to really potentially vasodilate my patient and cause a decrease in blood pressure. And that's not what we want to do when we've got a dog that is still trying to compensate for volume loss. So the other choice in our pre-meds are going to be the alpha-2 agonists. And again, that's going to drop our heart rate regardless. So that is going to impair the dog's compensation. So once again, that wasn't something I was planning to use. The dog was already quite flat and collapsed, and it's had the methadone. So we decided that was going to be sufficient as a pre-med for this patient. The problem is, if we don't use a very profound pre-med, then we don't offset the amount of induction agent we need. So what I often do, we'll use a co-induction agent to try and minimize the amount of induction agent I'll need. So we've all got our favorites. Some people use drugs like diazepam. I really like ketamine as a co-induction agent, because it also gives some analgesia as well, and I felt that may help with this case. It's quite a cardiovascularly stable drug as well, so I really like ketamine. Some people use an opioid. So there are lots and lots of different co-induction agents you can use. We decided to use ketamine, and we used alfaxolone for induction, not because it's a great induction agent for sick patients. There may be some advantages to it in these cases, but it's because we're used to using it, and for me that's the most important thing. So we got those drugs ready, we had a lidocaine infusion ready to go, we had fluids in theatre, and we had a plan ready for if the dog became hypotensive. So that was we were going to use a noradrenaline infusion, which would give vasoconstriction for the patient. So this is often used in human septic patients, because our goal is to maintain our pressure and maintain our perfusion to our organs. So we kind of had everything ready that we thought we might need.
And I think that's a really important point, isn't it? Because these dogs are hypoperfused or hypotensive because they have a combination to some degree of hypovolemia, so decreased blood volume, and then this vasodilation. And if you replace the volume in your initial stabilization period, then actually what you need to do in your next part is to vasoconstrict to make sure that they are perfusing as best they can. So it makes absolute sense to, for your plan to be noradrenaline. That's what I would do as well in these patients. So fluids first, make sure you're happy that you've got them fluid replete, and then move on to the noradrenaline or other vasopressor. And I think historically we've always used more and more fluids, and that's when we've ended up with patients that are very puffy edematous, because you just give them so much crystalloid and actually you're over perfusing them. They don't need it. And you'll always see an improvement in blood pressure if you give fluids, because that's what's going to happen. That fluid is going to go into the arteries, the blood pressure will improve, but it will tend to be transient. And there's a lot of work going on in human medicine about how we assess whether a patient is fluid responsive versus, so i.e. they need fluid versus don't need fluid. And our methods in veterinary medicine are really weak, I think, at the moment, but we'll be moving more towards how we decide whether fluids are the right thing to do in coming years, hopefully. But I was going to ask you a question. Oh, alfaxolone. So I used to work with a vet, and this is totally anecdotal, but I wanted to know what you thought about this. And he swore that if you diluted your alfaxolone, you gave less. Is that true, or do you just give it more slowly?
Yeah, no, it's completely true. And apologies for this. I did a study on it about 5 years ago, and I still haven't published it. But it's a really complicated reason. I'm not even going to go there, but yeah, if you dilute it, so I will normally do half and half with saline, put it down to a 5 mg/ml solution, and you will get away with slightly lower doses. Whether that is beneficial, so are the patients more cardiovascularly stable? I can't actually remember the results of my own study. I just remember that the actual total dose that you give is less. I can get back to you with that.
It's quite an interesting thing, isn't it? Because we use co-induction agents to reduce the total dose of anesthetic agent we give. And actually, there's two other things that you can do with alfaxolone. One might be diluting, as you said. I don't know how much less it is and whether that's clinically significant, but the other is actually just giving it really slowly, because I think if you're impatient with it, you end up giving loads, but actually if you give it time to work, you end up giving very little, I find. I have to work, kind of walk off, otherwise I can end up giving more. But it's I don't know if that's useful in these situations or not, but if you're giving oxygen at the same time, it's probably safe enough to do.
Yeah, so I mean, in our study, we did compare the timing. We made sure the timing of the actual milligram per kilo dose was exactly the same with both the diluted and the undiluted drugs. And the diluted drug, you took less to achieve induction. So, it's a very complicated pharmacokinetic explanation, which I will not bore anyone with. You don't need to know it, but I find it really useful in cats in particular. So dogs, I don't tend to dilute it as much nowadays. So it's really, if you've got a sick cat, then it makes it so much easier to give the drug, because the volumes that they're taking, like 0.4 of a mil is a tiny volume. Try giving that slowly to effect. It's very difficult. So, that's probably more the situation I'll dilute in nowadays.
Right. So I think that's all I had on that case. But essentially, to summarise, get your patient as stable as you can beforehand. Don't expect them to reach normal, and then plan for every eventuality during the anaesthetic. So plan how you're going to manage any episodes of hypotension. Get it all sorted. I used to have like automated sheets that I could print off for patients with certain body weights. So I could just put in 10 kilos and it would calculate all the emergency drug doses that I might need, including things like noradrenaline infusion. But they can be useful things to have. But be ready. And then go for it. Yep.
Yeah. And I think if you're in practice, if you're the vet and you're scrubbed in, then it's much better if your nurses have everything written down and you can just say which drug needs to go in. And if you're prepared, you won't need it.
Great. Okay. So moving on to cat's bums. So we had a couple of questions raised both on the forum and in practice about management of urethral obstruction in cats. And I think these cats can present with a massive range of compromise to their cardiovascular system. And these are two ECGs taken from cats that were blocked. So classic changes, loss of P waves, spiky T waves, and then a sine wave form at the bottom with very, very severe hyperkalemia. And what's your approach, Liz, with these patients? So we often, even though they're cardiovascularly compromised, they often need some kind of physical restraint to unblock them. And I think, you know, I think there are people who think stabilize, get them completely normal, potassium normal, et cetera, and then unblock a couple of hours later versus the let's do something quick and easy and unblock them as quickly as we can, because actually that will help us overall. Which camp do you fall in?
Depends what the ECG looks like. Okay. I prefer to get them unblocked sooner rather than later because, yeah, we've got all these different ideas of drugs that we can give and ways of driving potassium into cells to try and stabilize them. But the best way to bring that potassium down is to unblock the bladder. So sometimes it is a bit of a compromise in terms of you've just got to weigh up the kind of cost benefit, I guess, of going ahead immediately. So often if they're relatively cardiovascularly in a good way, I will often give them some sedation with an opioid is a great idea. So whichever you prefer within your practices, it could be butorphanol, it could be buprenorphine, methadone. And if they are very, we've caught it relatively early, then I'll often use an alpha 2 agonist as well, because I think that gives some really nice muscle relaxation and may help the urethral tone as well. The spasm that you get around these, crystals or whatever it is that's causing the obstruction. I think the sicker they are, the less sedation you need, and you can probably, in combination with an opioid sedation, maybe a bit of midazolam diazepam on top of that, you can perform an epidural if you're feeling good. And there's lots of reports as if by magic. So cats are really nice because you can feel your landmarks. So what's been suggested is a coccygeal epidural. So this is, you know, in the old days when you talked about putting epidurals into cows and you ramp the tail up and down to feel the space. That's exactly what we're going to do in cats. And often you've just got to get them to sit in sternal, and I kind of hang their bottoms a little bit off the table so the tail is hanging down. And then you just a little bit of movement of the tail, you'll be able to feel where you're aiming for. So it's a pretty easy technique to do when obviously when you first start doing it, it takes longer, but you know, after you've done a few, it probably only take you a couple of minutes to perform this procedure. They don't always work. So then you can either repeat or you can try a different method, whether that's just putting local onto the tip of your urinary catheter with a bit of KY jelly. You can mix the two together and then try advancing the UCATH, and then once it's getting to the point where you need it, that's when you could inject a little bit of local as well. So there are different ways you can do it if you don't manage to get a successful epidural. But I think some of the papers that have come out, you're looking at a 70% success rate. So I think it's something that's quick and easy to try. So as long as you know your landmarks well, it should be fairly doable procedure. And I just use lidocaine because it's quick acting. So you're going to know if that's works fairly quickly.
Cool. So there's two papers that I've popped up. One is the original one that was published, which was 7 years ago now. And then there was this one that was just been published in JVEC, although if you look, it was accepted in 2018, so it's a couple of years old. And they did 88 cats with urinary tract obstruction, urethral obstruction. And it was double-blinded, randomized and prospective. And they did sham epidural versus bupivacaine morphine epidural and showed that you needed... So success rate of 70%, as you said, and then decreased amount of anaesthetic agent for the catheterization. So it looks like a really nice technique. I've only used it a couple of times, and I don't know. I've always used it in association with anaesthesia, so I don't know how successful it was. But it's definitely not a very difficult technique. And if people do want more, there's a really nice link which hopefully will work here. So Vet Girl on the Run has a whole thing on it, so a whole page on it if you want to look at what you're doing, step-by-step approach, how to palpate, and how to do it, essentially. So Vet Girl on the Run is a good site to look at there. So that's if the cat's relatively stable. If it's unstable, I suppose I have a dual approach. One is to give fluids. A lot of these patients are fluid deplete, so I give them Hartmann's, and I start with about 10 mils per kilo in cats as a bolus, as long as there isn't any indication of cardiac disease. And then my go-to for management of hyperkalemia is calcium, which can have a really miraculous effect. Would you have a similar approach?
I think calcium is going to give you that stabilization immediately and buy you half an hour or so.
So that normally gives you enough time to finish it off. And I think I very, very, very rarely would use anything more than that in a standard urethral obstruction. Urinary tract trauma is different, but in these cases, I would just go with calcium. So the last question that I thought we'd cover, and we probably try and do this relatively swiftly. This is probably the hardest. So someone asked what we did in cats that were... that had HCM or other compromise that required sedation or anaesthesia for pleural evacuation. So if they need thoracocentesis, what do you do? So what do you do, Liz? We've got a cat with known HCM, it's got pleural effusion. What would you do?
If it's a known HCM, then I will actually use alpha-2 agonists because they're going to slow the heart rate down a little bit and potentially improve the outflow obstruction that you get with HCM. And they will provide a good sedation. So you're going to get reliable sedation so that you can get a face mask on them and give them supplemental oxygen while you're doing any imaging or you're draining the chest. Just depends what it is. If this was a cat where we didn't know it was HCM, so we were trying to decide what the cause was, I think a lot of people would say that using a drug like midazolam ketamine combination would be the safest bet. So I think it is a very nice drug for dyspneic cats. But there are some reports from America that if you use ketamine in an HCM cat, it can increase the mortality with them. So again, the alpha-2s for me are relatively safe as long as you're careful with them. So I tend to use lower doses of the drugs in combination with an opioid always. I tend to use butorphanol because it gives better sedation. If you combine it with an alpha-2 with buprenorphine, then the buprenorphine takes longer to work. So they often will vomit and the sedation isn't as good. So I tend to always use butorphanol in the first instance, and then if you think they need pain relief afterwards, then you can give them something different. So my approach tends to be an alpha-2, which may be a controversial thing to say, but it doesn't really affect the respiratory system. It will probably slow the rate of respiration down a wee bit, but it shouldn't affect the volume that they're expanding their lungs to. So For me, that's going to give you a very good level of sedation that you can handle the cat. You're not putting extra stress on the cat, which could also result in arrhythmias if it wasn't adequately sedated. So that's the way I do it. If I've got an IV catheter in, I'm looking at between 2 and 5 micrograms per kilogram of medetomidine or dexmedetomidine, whichever one you have on your shelves.
And do you worry about the effect on afterload, or is that minimal at those doses?
With HCM, I don't worry about it too much, to be honest.
Okay.
I mean, you can argue there are benefits and there are very negative points about using all of the drugs concerned. So you can also, if you need a bit more sedation, you can always combine a bit of midazolam or diazepam in there. So it depends on the temperament of the cat, but normally these cats are not very happy with restraint because they are trying to hold their own so that they can get their oxygen in. So I find often that a little bit of sedation will outweigh the risks with it.
Great. Okay. And so you mentioned ketamine and midazolam. Is alfaxan okay in these circumstances or not? Should we be avoiding that?
Yeah, alfaxan is quite a nice drug. Again, it's my go-to in cats. So if I've got the time, I use it in cardiac cases is mainly for echocardiography, where you don't want anything affecting your cardiac functions. So you want to be able to judge how well the heart is working. And if you give an alpha 2, it will increase afterload and change the dimensions of your heart and the way it's working. So I think in that situation, I will use intramuscular alfaxalone with butorphanol to achieve the mild sedation that you need from that.
Okay. Great. We're not going to do that one. We've done too much, I think. Kept everyone far too long already. Stop the screen. I've got any questions. But if anyone's got any questions, if you pop it up onto the chat now, we should be able to see them if you've got any. And if not, we're going to say goodbye and leave you all to the rest of your day and your coffee. Anyone got any questions? I'm going to give you about, I don't know, a minute. Cool. Oh my God, you've been amazing, obviously. Whoever started
recording. We just confused everyone.
Can we ask the noradrenaline dose? The noradrenaline dose for the hypertension.
Yeah. So when I'm using it, I start at 0.25. Mics per kilo per minute, is it, or mgs per kilo per minute? I don't know, my brain is not functioning anymore. I think it's mics per kilo per minute, and then increase it. You can go up to up to about 0.5, you will normally get control of the blood pressure, but it just depends on the patient. Some patients require more. It depends how vasodilated they are, so the responsiveness of the systemic sympathetic nervous system does alter in a lot of the disease states, so the dose can be quite variable.
Okay. So do you wait until they've had, so you start them on the 2.5, see what response they have. If they're still a bit hypotensive, increase it slightly.
Yeah. So it's a very short half-life, so you should see the effect within a couple of minutes.
Okay.
And then you can just double it, so keep going up.
Yes,
as long as it's going in next to the patient and it's not going in distant to the patient, as long as you know you're delivering it into the patient directly.
Not through a load of extensions.
So I think you need to, if you're titrating it to affect you, you should be increasing the dose relatively frequently, because of that short half-life, as Liz said.
Cool. Thank you.
Good. I don't think we've got any questions. I think we're done. I think Did you start the recording, Liz, or was it David?
No, David's done it.
Okay, fantastic. So thank you very, very much, David, for doing that. I'll leave it in your capable hands to see if you can link it anywhere. And I hope this has been useful for anyone. Feedback on the page, let us know. And if anyone wants any other topics, then also let us know, because we're happy to do it. But thank you all for coming.
Bye. Bye. David, who are you? Who is she?
Holy shit.